Two. Hey everyone, and welcome back to The Advisor. Before we get started, I just want to say thank you to Dr. Bradley Nelson and iHeartRadio for your sponsorship. And I want to send a shout out to our fans, our listeners, everybody out there who is supporting us. We love you. Please do not forget to hit that like and subscribe button before you leave today. Today is an important topic, and it's one that hits close to home for me. And I have a really special guest here with us today, and his name is Mark Astor. He is the founder of Astor Simovich Law, where he leads a mission that's driven, it's a mission-driven legal practice that specializes in mental health, substance abuse, and guardianship law. And so he is trusted by families across Florida, and he really works tirelessly to restore rights and to protect loved ones and bring hope to those families in the darkest moments. If you or anyone you know has been through addiction, you know how treacherous that path can be. And Mark is someone out there that is helping to restore families by giving them simple tools that they can use to rebuild after addiction wreaks havoc on a system. It is such an honor to meet you. Thank you so much for being here, Mark.
I am so thrilled to be here with you, and I'm flattered that you're having me as a guest. And I think you did a better intro than I could even do for myself. So I appreciate that. Thank you.
Yeah, no, you're welcome. Right before we hit record, I was telling you about my story, and you were sharing with me a little bit about yours. And it's a passion of mine to want to get the message out there that there is hope for people that are going through addiction, because it can be one of the darkest things that a family can go through, never mind the person that is the addict. So thank you for the work you do, and for showing up today and wanting to lead and inspire.
Well, listen, I always enjoy sharing my story because I think that there's an opportunity to save, even if it's just one person and one family, then that we've done good today. And I think actually your listeners will probably help a lot more than just one. But I'm grateful that you shared your journey with me a little bit before we came on online. And I was grateful for that. I was humbled by that. Thank you for doing it.
Yes, you're so welcome. Let's start there. Why don't you tell everyone a little bit about who you are?
So I'm an attorney. We're based here in Palm Beach County, Florida. We also have an office in Orlando. We just opened one in Jacksonville, and we also have an office in Massachusetts. The mission of the firm since February of 16 has been to save families whose loved ones are suffering from substance use, mental health disorders, and failed attempts at recovery. So the team and I speak to moms and dads from all over the country. As far west as Hawaii, as far north as sort of that New England corridor, and occasionally outside of the country too. And they call us because they have somebody in the family, typically an adult child, 25 to 45, with a long history of drug use and mental illness and the treatment that doesn't seem to work. And they're probably at some point have been med non-compliant. They may well have been a guest of their particular state, either through the criminal system or the mental health system. They may even have had an overdose, and they call us and say, "Hey, we're done. We can't take it anymore. The family is being destroyed. We've hit rock bottom. We hear that you can help. Can we talk to you?" And that's how the conversation typically starts.
So, why are you doing what you do?
Yeah, I think it's been a bit of a journey for me. I'm not in recovery, although I. Not from substances and mental health. I think I'm rec in recovery from the legal profession, because they say lawyers are twice as likely to develop a substance use disorder, and actually working to help other lawyers with regards to those issues has become a bit of a mission of mine too. But so I started my legal career in 1994, and I was a prosecutor. I was an assistant state attorney down here in Palm Beach County, and I was there until 1999. By which time I was thoroughly burned out and decided it was time to leave. But pretty early on, I realized that there was something, frankly, just a little bit wrong with our criminal justice system here in Florida, which was that I was seeing the same faces over and over and over again. And the conclusion I came to was these are folks that have behavioral health issues. And the mandate, even today, Lisa, here in Florida in the criminal system, is to punish first and rehabilitate second. Now, back in the mid 90s, we didn't have some of these specialty courts that we now have, like drug court and mental health court and veterans court. Well, if there's no other way, if there's no other option to divert you out of the criminal justice system, eventually they just lock you up and they throw the key away. And that can happen not just in the criminal system, but it can also happen in Florida's mental health system. And in my experience, the state does a pretty lousy job. And I think that's being complimentary. They do a lousy job of taking care of people when it comes to behavioral health issues. So in 1999, I left. I was really burned out. I did some criminal defense work. I made a lot more money. I got married and I got divorced. And frankly, I was really just downright miserable. And I said, I'm not going to practice law anymore. I'm done. I took a year off in 2004. I went to DC. I got my master's in law. I worked on a presidential campaign for a year. And the candidate I worked for, he didn't win, so I had to come back. I was back in Florida for several years, trying to make a living without practicing law. In 2010, I ran off to California. I had a cousin who lived there, and I took what money I had left off the 08 crash, and I just went to California, hoping that I would find, the answer, whatever that meant. I spent 3 years there. I took the bar out there 3 times and failed it all 3 times, which was a little frustrating because I think I studied for the Florida bar for 3 weeks and I was working at the same time and passed. And I spent almost a year studying for the California bar and couldn't pass it. And, friends and family were saying, you're not supposed to be in California. You're not supposed to be in California. So I came back. This is about 11 years ago now. And then I basically met somebody that completely changed the direction of my life. So you want to talk about that too? I'm happy to share that.
Yeah, I mean, who changed your whole life?
So in about 11 years ago, I got invited to a breakfast meeting down here in the Gables, which is
Oh,
about,
I feel like this is a love story. My heart
it's not a
straight,
love
I
story,
can
but
feel it in
maybe
my.
it's a more of a bromance than a love story. But
But
I got a
it's
chance.
the same thing.
Okay, I got a chance just to hear, to see. I don't know if you know. Your guests may not be familiar with R. John Robbins. R. John Robbins is the founder of a company called How to Manage a Small Law Firm. And How to Manage a Small Law Firm teaches solo and small law firm practitioners like us the business side of being a lawyer, how to be an entrepreneurial lawyer, which is not something they teach anywhere in any law school, anywhere in this country, right? And I watched him speak and for about 2 hours to about 20, 25 lawyers. They all looked at him like he had three heads. But for me, it was like an awakening. I came from an entrepreneurial family. My father left school at 14. My mother left school at 16. So they weren't educated, at least not in the traditional sense. My father built businesses. My mother helped him. Some were good, some were bad. He made money, he lost money. But basically, after seeing him speak for about an hour and a half, I begged him for a job. And I got hired. Now, what I didn't realize at the time, Lisa, was that in addition to teaching lawyers about being an entrepreneurial lawyer, what How to Manage a Small Law Firm really is at their core is that they are a personal growth company for lawyers. And God only knows we need it. And they teach that personal growth must precede financial growth. And I spent a year there not only learning about being an entrepreneurial lawyer, but finally realizing the reason I'd been so miserable and unsuccessfully, both professionally and personally, was that I hadn't taken 100% responsibility for my life, for my
Yeah.
failures and successes. And I said, okay, if I'm going to take responsibility, what do I want to do? Because I mean, I'm 58 now. I was 47 at the time. And I'm like, well, if I'm not going to do it now, when am I going to do it? And so I decided I wanted to open up my own law firm. I had close family members, friends who had behavioral health issues. I said, that's who I'm going to help. Now, I didn't really know how I was going to do it. I had a background in criminal law. I was familiar with the Marchman Act, which is a pretty unique statute here in Florida, which we can get into. And I sat myself down in the library here in Boca in February of 2016 with no money, but a mission. And I created a spreadsheet of all the people I could think of. I went through my phone book and I just started calling people. I made coffee appointments, lunch appointments. I made appointments to speak to anybody and meet with anybody who would hear what I had to say. I got the cheapest business cards I could make through Vistaprint, and I drove around to treatment centers and I handed out my business card. And they said, "We've never heard of you." And I said, "I know you haven't, but soon you will." And for the first 14 months, I took all kinds of cases, criminal cases, family law cases, anything that would pay a bill. 11 months in, I lost my dad. So it was a tough time. And I spent the next 2 years living with my mom. One, because she needed me, and two, because I didn't have any money or credit. So it was convenient. After the first year, I was able to get a really small executive suite. My first office was just a tiny bit bigger than the desk that was sitting in it, so I had enough room to walk around. And in 2017, I met my now wife, who had a background in guardianship work. She had practiced up in Massachusetts for many years with husband when she was married to husband number one. And what we figured out was we could use the guardianship statute, which traditionally had only ever been used for elderly people. And we're like, I know, I bet we could use it for the kinds of cases that we handle. And that has been an absolute game changer for us. So when you hear other lawyers who are now using guardianship for behavioral health issues, my wife is the guru of that. She wrote the book on how to use guardianship for a behavioral health case. And for the next 7 years, it was just, my wife and I working 8 days a week, 25 hours a day, doing everything, the sales, the marketing, the legal work, meeting with clients, running to court. I mean, I still work most weeks, 6 days a week. I spoke to two families yesterday. So, I mean, it became a real labor of love for us and a real mission. The last 2 years, we've been able to hire a bunch of staff. So now there's 12 of us, which means we can help a bunch more people. It also means I can sit here and have a conversation with you, and I'm not having to pick up the phone. So it's really been an amazing ride. And our goal for next year is to help a lot more people in different states. And so we are very mission driven with a set of core values that, that everybody in the team has to buy into. And I love what I do. I met my wife, I have two amazing stepchildren. And I always say by saving other families, I saved my own.
Tell us what your mission is.
My mission is to try and save as many families as I have. As I was telling you before we came on, I was on the phone with a mom, who's got a 28-year-old son, who just has really not been able to launch his life. And I think there are some issues there. I mean, there's some autism there. I think there's some personality disorders there, some narcissistic behavior, but he's been in and out of treatment forever. And he's got a sibling that's, by all accounts, a shining star in the family. And yet here's somebody who barely got out of high school, and he just I mean, he can, he can function daily, but he can't hold down a job. He can't have an intimate relationship at an NHR. And, at some point when his parents shuffle off the planet, I mean, what's going to become of him? And that's what I think is the biggest fear. So how do we get him the help he needs? He's been seeing a clinician. They've medicated him up the wazoo. Doesn't seem to have changed much. And so it's really about figuring out how do we help him? How do we get the family position, number one, that they can start making decisions for him that are in his best interest? Because like many people with a behavioral health issue, he doesn't think there's anything wrong with him. He thinks his behavior is perfectly normal. Well, obviously it's not normal. But poor mom, like the thousands of other moms I've spoken to at this point, she doesn't sleep, she can't function, and she is tired. And she's like, "Can you help me?" I can, but it's going to take a little time. Because there's no magic wand for recovery.
So what kind of things do you do then? So I shared with you earlier that, I went through an addiction that was destroying my family, and I ended up moving back in with my family when I was in my early 20s to kind of pick myself up. But I was still using, and so I look back and I can see how that was destroying my family and the ripple effect of that. So what kind of things would you have done if my mom would have called you and said, "This is what's going on. Can you help us?" Like, what is your intervention plan?
Okay, can I ask you a question, Lisa, if that's okay?
Yes,
So
absolutely.
when you were in the midst of this, the throes of this, did you think there was anything wrong? Did you think this was normal? I mean, your behavior?
When I was in the midst of it,
Yeah.
no, I felt like that was I was being controlled by the substance. So it was like, that was my life. That was my best friend. That was all that I wanted all the time. I was obsessed with it. It was the only thing that would get me up in the morning. It was the only thing that would give me confidence. It was the only thing that would make me feel good. All my power was given to that. So everything else in my life could care less about. I would do anything to get that substance.
How did you finally get clean? Had you finally experienced recovery?
I was in and out of different rehabs, but one day, I call it God, miracle, knowing that in my heart, I knew that that wasn't my life and woke up one day and was ready. It was a readiness that I'd never felt in my life. And it was like, okay, now's the time. I can finally get clean. It was like that holding on to that love in my heart that I was meant for something more in the world and never letting that go.
Yeah, and I think your story is quite amazing. I would tell you though, from my experience, you're the exception to the rule, right? You had that awakening, whether it's spiritual, religious, whatever it happens to be, somehow you realize you needed to change your life, and you finally were able to experience recovery and go through the recovery process. But the families that call us, Lisa, they're in a situation where their loved one, at least right now, is not able to come to that conclusion. They're not able to have
I had
that
an
inner
uncle who thought it
conversation.
was normal to show up to Christmas drunk and fall down the stairs, and that was fine. So he didn't think anything was wrong.
Yeah, and for a lot of families, waiting for that sort of, I don't know, for lack of a word of a come to Jesus moment may never happen. And sometimes that leads to a tragic, a tragic result. And it's not unusual for us to call a family 6 months after they've initially called us and decided not to ask our help, and we find out something tragic happened. So the families that call us, it's the family that's hit rock bottom. And for the most part, their loved one is not even capable of appreciating the fact that they need help. So if the family, excuse me, if their loved one doesn't have that moment like you did and realizes they need help and cannot ask for help, then how are they going to get it? Well, one of two things. One of two ways they're going to get it. Either the state at some point is going to take control of the situation and either commit them to the criminal justice system or commit them to the mental health system. Neither of those tend to get great results. The other option is that the family takes control and they get the authority to make the decision to save their loved one, which is a decision their loved one cannot make because at some point their loved one's brain was kidnapped by whatever is controlling the situation, whether it's substances, whether it's mental illness, or a combination thereof. They're not objectively capable of even acknowledging that there's a problem because for them, this is just normal. Everybody else is looking at them like, how can you do this? But they're looking at the family like, I'm fine. There's nothing wrong with me. But what's the problem here? And so for us, it's about getting control of an out of control situation and giving the family the ability to make the decision to save their loved one, whatever that happens to look like. So there's really three components to this, Lisa. The first one is legal. There are three statutes here in Florida that we operate under, one of which, as you pointed out at the beginning, is the guardianship statute. But we also have Marchman Act and we also have the Baker Act. And most states have a variation of what we have. I would tell you, I think that the statutes down here are really second to none. They give tremendous power and authority, but it's really about the family deciding how much control do you want? Do you just want to send Mark to treatment for the next 3 to 6 months? Or do you want to be able to control more where he lives, who he spends time with? Do we want to get access to his medical records, control his finances? Do we want to revoke his ability to drive? Do we want to restrict his ability to travel so he doesn't jump on a plane and disappear? All of those things. So again, what do you really want? And it really that allows us to sort of tailor the relief that we can seek from a court. But ultimately, it's about the family making the commitment of time, of energy, and money to save their loved one. And frankly, by the time they get to us, they've already been through this for years. They're really tired, and they may well have spent a boatload of money. So asking to make one more leap of faith is a big ask. So the first component is legal. Right, getting them the authority from a court to make that decision that their loved one cannot make. So The
My God,
second.
when you said that, right before you said that, I was like, how do you handle that? You know, it's like you took it right out of my brain as I'm thinking of this family doing everything they can and then coming to you and they're so defeated and they're so exhausted and they feel like their life is over and they're destroyed and then they come to you. Gosh, how do you handle that? I'm just like being real, like that must be so challenging at times.
It's tiring. And when it was just me and my wife, it was even more tiring. But, that's why I built a team to help us with that, right? Because as we've helped more families and we have more clients we're working with, I've had to spread the load a bit. And, we're really careful about who we, frankly, who we hire. And if they're not a good fit and they don't buy into the mission and the core values, then we have to part ways with them. We're just not, it's just not a good fit for us. So, hiring the right people is really important. Really, really important because these are families that are desperate and they need help, and that's what they come to us for. So that's what we're here to do.
Yeah.
So, getting the authority is great, but the other component, the second of the three components, is what I call clinical. It's really important not only to put somebody into treatment for long enough, but in a facility that's clinically appropriate, because otherwise it's just an exercise in futility. Now, a lot of the time, the family already has a treatment center that's lined up, and they may even have been referred to us by the treatment center. Great. That sounds good. Unless it's a facility that, there's only a few of them that I'm adamant about not working with because I'm really careful who we work with. Great. If we've got treatment lined up, fantastic. So we've got the clinical. But if we don't, I have two clinicians that are sort of a la carte options for families. One's a clinical psychologist, one's a licensed clinical social worker. And if a family wants, they can do a consult with the clinicians. They can hire them. Let's find the right place to place your loved one, the right facility. And if there's insurance involved, let's make sure that insurance is covered too, because families have been paying the premium all these years. They want the benefits that they've been paying for. And the third component, Lisa, which I think is just key and critical, is what I call law enforcement. So I have a retired cop on staff with a team of investigators, because we get a lot of calls. People are missing. They're on the streets. They walk out of treatment. And, while I'm a big fan of law enforcement, they simply don't have the resources to go looking for people. So we'll do it for them. I mean, we'll go out there, we'll find somebody. If I can get a judge to give me a court order to pick somebody up, once we find them, then, we'll reach out to law enforcement and say, hey, can you send two deputies down here? We have a pickup order in our hands and we have this person. Come and get them so we can get them off the streets to a place of safety. And then we can go back and see the judge and have a conversation about what the next steps might be. So, I mean, we have just found over the years that you need those three components. That's the key. But even with all of that, I mean, recovery is a process. It takes time. It
Yeah.
just does, right? The movie where the person goes to bed, sits in a cold sweat for a week, and then wakes up and says, "Oh, I'm good." I mean, I tell families that's the
Oh,
movies.
that's
That's
bullshit. That's
not real
bullshit.
life. Not in my world, anyway. It
That's
just doesn't
not
work
real.
that
I
way.
can assure you that. It's learning how to, from a recovered addict's perspective, it's learning how to live again. It's like being reborn into a world where nothing feels good because your body has zero good chemicals left in it. It's so depleted. And then it's like everything is challenging. It's learning how to live again and step out of bed and make your bed. It's all of those things plus a million different other things because you're an adult. And then there's the pressure of having to be an adult. So it's incredibly challenging. The
Do you go to
sweats
meet?
and the detox. That's the easiest part because you're laying in bed and you can rest. But after that, it's like, here you go. Like, have at her. Good luck.
Lisa, do you go to meetings regularly?
Oh no, I've been like, I do like speak. I speak. I do inspirational speak. I volunteer as a mentor.
So
That's how I give back,
you're
and
a
that's the
sponsor.
medicine.
Are you
Yeah.
sponsored? Yeah. And so, look, I think that, and I wanted to ask you that question because I think that sometimes we get families that call and say, well, let's put them into treatment for 30 days. He'll be good to go. No.
No.
Recovery is a journey. It's not a destination. Look, I'm really happy I got a chance to meet you. I've got a number of friends who are in recovery. I've been really blessed that way. One of my good friends has been in recovery 15 years, 20, maybe even 20. I can tell you without exception, wherever he happens to be in the world, at least once a week he goes to a meeting. Every
Okay.
week. He works on his recovery every single day of his life. And whatever that looks like for him. And for different people, it's a different process. But people in recovery work on their recovery. And I'm so glad that you shared that with us, because it's important for families to know, it's not go to treatment for 30 days, you're done. No, I tell families it's a year-long journey. You don't have to hire us for a year, but think of this as a year-long journey, which is not only important for your loved one to be able to experience recovery and develop the skill set and the habits to maintain it, but that's a year that we want the family to use for them to heal. Because in a year's time, your loved one's going to be over here and you're still going to be here, right? You're still going to be in the status quo. And you have got to take that time, because you're going to deal with a whole new person when the recovery really starts to take hold. And I'm sure your family experienced that. And families are traumatized by this. They're tired, they're exhausted. And it's so important, when you're
The
working with the
trust, the
people,
rebuilding of the trust is a huge phase.
everything. So it's not just when I say we say families, that's what I mean. It's about the recovery journey for everyone, not just their loved one. It's everybody.
Yeah, so important, so incredibly important. So where can, people find out more information about what you do and how, like, just tell us a little bit more about what you do.
Yeah, I mean, so we are a law firm, but we have a very different mission. One of the things I've been very blessed to be able to do is we've been able to help. I put a number of lawyers into treatment, believe it or not. I've also had lawyers as clients. I've had judges call us. I think people don't understand. They think that, maybe the behavioral health issues discriminate, right? It only picks on a certain, genre or race or sexual orientation. It doesn't. It picks on everybody. And it doesn't care. So, we understand that, and we have represented, people from all different faiths and backgrounds. And, we've also had a number of families who had, somebody from the transgender community that brings, its own clinical challenges, with it. So, over the years, we've really had to adapt and find different programs. I mean, my wife and I spend a lot of time speaking to clinicians, going to different treatment centers, going to conventions, behavioral health conventions and conferences, so we can find different resources for our families. Because, I mean, things are evolving, people evolve, things change. And you can't just say, oh, well, here's a treatment center, call me in 30 days. Those days are over, and Florida's had its own issues. So, I mean, we're a law firm that's evolving with our clients and our clients' needs, and we're here to help. And I have a lot of resources that you can have for free.
Beautiful. I know. So I was a functioning addict, and I actually worked as a paralegal. And I remember doing drugs in the bathroom at the law firms that I was working at. But I also remember some of the lawyers that I was working with, they would have bottles in their desk, and they would smell like alcohol. And I love how you said that. Like, mental health addiction, it doesn't discriminate. It's not a specific group of people. It's not people who are less fortunate. It's all of us. And you can't look at someone and really understand what they're going through, or that they could be an addict. That was one of the challenges I had, is I was able to have a poker face, because I would show up and I look presentable, and I appear to have my shit together, let's just say, but I was doing drugs in the bathrooms, So when I finally came clean and said, I have a problem, a lot of people were floored by that. But it doesn't discriminate, and I really want the audience to understand that, is it could be your best friend, and you don't really have an idea. What are some of the simple little things that start to unravel when someone's life kind of starts to lose control? Like, what can people look out for?
Yeah, I always tell mums and dads, Lisa, to be really nosy parents, right? And a lot of the time I'll speak, especially, and it's normally the mum that calls first, and I say, well, how do you know? And you know what they tell me? I just know. Well, how do you know, right? And
Mother's
obviously, there's
intuition.
mother's intuition, right? And that's a pretty powerful force in the universe. But as lawyers, obviously, we're governed by rules of evidence, rules of procedure, and substantive
Right.
law. So I got to make sure we can prove this, right? Because if I can't tell the judge, well, mom just knows, because the judge is going to laugh at me and then have the deputies
Oh, but that
escort
should
me
be
out of court.
the way.
Right? I wish it was. I wish it was. But I think what moms tend to notice is changes in things, right? You know, perhaps
Energy,
they're
yes.
flunking out of school, or they can't hold down a job, or they're hanging out with different people, or maybe they found paraphernalia in the house, or they've seen them using, they've admitted they're using, their eating habits change, their bathing habits change. You know, they're sleeping all day, they're up all night. I mean, you know, their basic functioning on a day-to-day basis, just it's like they're living in the bizarro world to you know, first. If you ever saw the Seinfeld episode when they were all in the bizarro world, when someone's dealing with a behavioral health issue, they're living in a bizarro world. Their entire world flips upside down. And over time, those differences really start to, you know, to really, they grow. And when they're confronted, you know, they're like, nothing wrong with me, leave me alone. And the more they're
Yeah.
confronted, the more aggressive they become about, there's nothing wrong with me. And so, and they're in denial. And so, you know, you can confront them with all of these things. You could have a video of them using in the back garden, and they were like, not me.
That wasn't me.
That doesn't look like me. You got the wrong person. I'm fine. Right? That's how bad he is. That's how kidnapped their mind has become. They can't even acknowledge when they are confronted with it and see it on video.
Oh God, if I even told you the stories I made up, absolutely insane. Yeah. Best liars, worst liars. I don't know, but we're liars when we're in that state of mind. Denial, denial, denial.
So, what else would you like to know, Lisa? I'm happy to sit here and chat with you as long as you need me to, but hopefully, you know,
Yeah.
some of the audience will, you know, realize that
Yeah,
there is
so
hope
no, it
out
was
there.
just I think the work that you guys are doing is incredible. And the fact that there's people out there that have a place that they can turn to that can help them start picking their lives back up when this is happening and can take control of a situation. Because, like I said before, it's a really helpless feeling for a family, not knowing what to do. How are we going to handle this? How do we take control of the situation? So, it's really great to know that someone can pick up the phone, contact you guys, and at least that's a start.
Yeah, and I think it really starts, Lisa, with the family saying, you know, there's a problem here and we can't fix it. As much as we'd like to, we can't wish it away. We need help. And it's okay to feel that way. It's okay to ask for help because you're not alone. You know, the mom I just spoke to, I said to, you know, I've spoken to thousands of moms over the years. You're not alone. And I think that was a bit of a relief for her because, you know, a lot of time families suffer in silence, right? They don't want anybody else to know because we have this sort of stigma attached to the problem. But they're not alone, and there's a lot of people out there, you know, that will say, "Hey, you know, my family went through this too." So yeah, I mean, look, I have a lot of resources. You know, one of the things that I really pride myself on is trying to give as much information away as I possibly can for free. I mean, look, families can go and Google this stuff. There's tons of garbage and misinformation out there. I put a video out almost every single day, Lisa, that talks about the issues that we face. And they're all, for the most part, based on real cases. You know, because look, you could go read the law. You don't need me to. You could go Google the Marchman Act and you could go read the statute, right? You could read it as well as I can. But how does it really work? How does it work in the real world? How does it work from one county to the next? Because things are handled differently in different counties. So you need to know those things, and the only way you know those is if you've handled them in these different counties. And you know, so that's important. If your loved one's not in Florida, well, how do we get them here? Because they need to be in Florida for the court here to have jurisdiction over them. And if they are here, well, how do we keep them here? So all these things have to be considered. And if at the end of the day you decide you don't want to be in the courtroom with your loved one, okay, what options are there? Well, maybe a world-class interventionist that we know. An intervention is a great way to get somebody into treatment. You know, doesn't necessarily keep them there, but if you're not ready to run to court, I'm happy to say to you, you know what, Lisa, I've got another option for you. Or, you know what, Lisa, I don't think we have enough evidence here that I could win this case. Why don't we talk about another option? I'm not going to take a case that I don't think we can win, because that only adds insult to injury. We go to court, we lose. Now the family's like, well, we tried everything. We just, put our faith in this lawyer and we lost the case. So we're not going to take a case we don't think that we can prove and win. Does every case, do we win every single case? No lawyer wins every single case. Do things go south? Yeah, there are some things I can't control. A witness doesn't come to court. A witness says something that they didn't tell us on the phone. Or the judge makes a quirky ruling. That is the legal system. But as a general rule, we get great results for our clients. But if we get you a court order and we get your loved one into treatment, you got to work the program too, right? It just takes time and you have to be a tiny bit patient, which is a big ask for a family who's been dealing with this for years and years. But it's so worth the journey. It really is. When we see that miracle, it's a beautiful thing, but it takes time. It really does.
Where can people find you?
So, our main website is mentalhealthaddictionlawfirm.com. That's mentalhealthaddictionlawfirm.com. The main phone number to the office is 561-419-6095, or just Google my name, Mark G. Astor. You'll probably find a video on Google, and I'm on LinkedIn and Twitter and Facebook and Instagram and YouTube and TikTok and so there's a video there every day, and you can. I've also got two books on both the websites. There's an ebook. You can download them for free. You can call my office and speak to either Brittany or Jeff, who are in my intake department. You can speak to them for free. So we have a ton of resources that are available to you. And if you want an interventionist, ask Brittany or Jeff. They'll be glad to refer you to somebody for free, somebody that I would call if it was my family. So all of these things are out there. And if we don't think an intervention's the right ticket, or if you've tried it and it hasn't worked, and obviously it depends why it didn't work, then yeah, then maybe we need to have a sit down about what working with us from a legal perspective is going to look like. So that is my mission,
Amazing.
Lisa. Thank you for allowing me to share it.
Thank you for being here. And like I said, for giving families hope and next steps in this really challenging process.
It is challenging, isn't it? It's worth it. And you're an inspiration because people would look at you and say, I don't believe it. Look at her. She looks amazing, right? And I look at my friend who's been in recovery for 20 years. You'd never know by looking at him, right? But you call him on a Wednesday night at 8 o'clock. He's going to be like, I'm in a meeting. Call you back. Click.
Yeah, you know what? One thing I took from today is you've humbled me, and perhaps I should, start going back to those meetings, even if it's just to sit there and listen and share. And like you said, the process of recovery is never over. We really have to continue working on these things every single day, and we must do that because if a little piece of a thread starts to unravel, then that thread gets pulled on, and then things start unraveling more and more and more. So, again, thank you so much for your inspiration and for being here and for sharing with the audience all the wonderful things that you do.
Thank you for having me.
And to our audience, if anybody you know is struggling with addiction, or if you are someone in a family who is struggling with someone who is going through addiction, please get in touch with Mark and his law firm. We will have all of the links for you linked in the show notes for easy access. Addiction, mental health, recovery, these are all real things, and a lot more people are struggling than you would ever believe or imagine. So stop judging people and start reaching out. Lend them an olive branch. Everybody could use some help. Until next time, take care, everyone.